Friday, January 6th, 2023. It's 9:02 a.m. We're at the Park Ward Plaza. So we will call this meeting to order. If everybody could stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Elizabeth, would you mind helping with the roll call, please?
I would love to. Jason Worthen.
Here.
Kimberly Guido.
Here.
Craig Vance.
Here.
John McCole.
Here.
Willis Gandhi.
Here.
Jen Johnson.
Here.
Hal Needham.
Here.
Heidi Whitehead. Virgie Grubb.
Here.
Bob Bullwinkle. Carla Clay. Sharon Turpak.
Here.
Kyle Clark.
Here.
Allison Buckteen. I see you up there, Allison.
Here.
Russell Cole.
Here.
Rhonda Greghurst.
Here.
Wonderful.
All right. Thank you. We have a quorum. Do we have any conflict of interest declarations?
No conflict of interest.
All right. No conflict of interest. Any requests to address the committee?
There were no requests to address the committee.
All right. Hearing none, we will get started with today's meeting. First item is item 6, and that's discuss and consider approval of meeting minutes from our October 7th, 2022 meeting.
I made a motion.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion to accept and a second by Craig. Any discussion? All right, take it to a vote. All in favor with a show of hands? Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries. All right, item 7. We have a first for BMAC this month, or I guess this existence. Item 7, we have a recognition of a friend of Galveston Beaches. And Elizabeth Schneider is going to present this item for us.
Wonderful. Good morning, everyone.
While Elizabeth gets that together, I can tell you at our pre-meeting meeting that Ms. Guido, myself, and Kimberly had discussed the agenda, what's going to be on the agenda of future agenda items. We thought it would be appropriate in an attempt over the years, we want to kind of build a, like we've talked about, it's had different names, Patrons of the Beach, Friends of the Beach, Galveston Clean Team. And so we've tried to encourage the community and recognize people in the community or organizations that are trying to help with litter on the beach, debris, things of that sort. And in an attempt to kind of grow that program, we wanted to recognize some of the individuals and groups that are helping us in those attempts.
Yes, thank you, Jason, for the introduction as we got settled in. Today we are honoring our first group. I know you can. I'm afraid if I move it, I'm going to maximize it again, but let's see. There you go. We have our Clean Team 6 here today. They are from the Isla del Sol community, and they clean the beach in that area. They have 27 members, and they were founded in 2021, the summer, led by Mr. Greg Hurt. He and Kimberly and Larry got together and they talked about a problem when they had all noticed, which was the trash on our beaches, and they got to work on fixing it. So today we have quite a few members joining us. Boyd and Helen Carr, Dennis and Patty Blackwood, Marie Brocato, and Mr. Greg Hurt. So they have some great pictures up there. The picture to the right is actually from Bell's Landing, which is a cleanup they just did out at the historical marker in West Columbia right off the Brazos River. But they noticed they had gone just, you know, for pleasure and then realized how nobody had taken care of it in a while. So they went out, drove up to West Columbia, a group of them, and cleaned the area. Again, we would just like to say thank you, the Park Board and the Beach Maintenance Advisory Committee, for all you do for the community. I know quite a few of you guys are out there every single day cleaning, and it is quite the endeavor. So if Mr. Gregor, if you'd like to say a few words, we'd like to invite you up.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Elizabeth.
I don't know where to start. My neighbor Joe Santangelo and I started cleaning up, and we got involved with Kimberly and Larry Jackson were so kind to lend us the tools and the t-shirts and so forth. And I guess the greatest thing about this has been an opportunity to meet these people. They just donate their time to help us out. And it, I'm sorry, I get choked up at things like this. So today, Marie Brocato, David Smith, where's David Smith and his wife, Elizabeth Faye, and Boyd and Helen Carr, Dennis Blackwood are here. But I do want to recognize several other people that aren't here. First of all, well, of course, Joe, who lives in Florida half the time, and I wish he were here, but he's been very helpful. Frank Kalevi cleans up the area behind our subdivision in the wetlands. He's gone out there, and you wouldn't believe the stuff he's brought in out of the wet. So Frank has been a really, really big help. Helen, although it took some convincing, she's been very helpful as well. The one picture you saw of over at Bell's Landing, Art and Pat Murray came over, and they were very helpful in cleaning up that historical marker. And I guess one of the greatest things about this is how much about Texas history I've learned since living in Galveston Island. It's unbelievable. I mean, I'm a native Texan. I grew up in Texas and went to college in Texas. But I've learned more about Texas history since I've lived in Galveston for the last 4 years than I ever did before. But thank you for honoring our team. And we'll continue to do our thing. We appreciate it. And unless there's anything else, we'll have to leave and go clean the beach. We don't want to listen to the rest of the meeting. But thank you. And anytime you have donuts and coffee, I'll show up, okay? Thank you. And I didn't mention Raphael, who's left the team, your team, but he was very helpful too. So we all appreciate it. And thank you all.
Weber, Senior Coastal Engineer with Aptum. I've been with the company for about a year now. We have Mike Lowick on the line. He's remote. He is our lead surveyor. He's been running the Galveston Island surveys for about 4 years now. He would have been here, but it turns out me getting here from Austin is easier than him getting here from Boca. So we're going to do a quick overview of what the surveys were this year, what we've been doing, and then we'll take questions. So it'll be a little high level. We won't go too deep into anything. So as questions come up, just please let us know. Mike, can you hear us all right online?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, thank you very much.
Would it be possible to share his presentation? We're still seeing the previous one.
Yeah, let me see what I can do real quick. Allison, can you see it now?
Yes, thank you.
All right, that answer was above my pay grade, so thank you very much. I'm with Aptum Coast Ports Marine Group. We have over 80 offices around the United States. Our coastal engineering, we focus a lot of our efforts in Gulf of Mexico. I'm the commercial director, engineer for Texas. And we have a very strong work that we do in Florida with a lot of experience on beaches, beach structures, beach management. For general coastal capabilities, we're a full-service engineering firm. We focus on coastal engineering projects in general, a lot of preservation, a lot of restoration. As we all know, this is becoming a much higher focus for the national purview, and we like to see the amount of interest that is coming back down to the Gulf of Mexico coast and Texas specifically. We work with contract preparations, project monitoring. We have coastal engineers, coastal scientists, and environmental engineers that all help pull these multidisciplinary projects together. For our geomatics, we've been doing this for a very long time. Hydrographic surveys, it's kind of the Wild West of surveying, but it's getting much better. We do a lot of work, a lot of QAQC to make sure that we have our traditional survey techniques in place, and then we also are working with the newer technologies as they're developing, coming out with the drone surveys, the photogrammetry, and then the GNSS is just the RTK geomatics, the 3D laser scanning, fascinating technologies. They have the kind of benefits for wholesale data collection that we just haven't seen, but in the past 5 to 10 years or so, where they're becoming extremely accurate, so that the amount of information, the amount of data that we can collect really facilitates the analysis of what's going on with the beaches. The coastal engineering, it's large-scale projects, small-scale projects. We are a holistic approach. The knee bones connect with the thigh bone, connect with the hip bone. You can't have one without the other. It takes planning, it takes engineering, it takes the environmental regulatory all to come together to put these projects together. Ultimately putting beneficial projects into the ground. So that's really what we like to focus on as a company, as a coastal engineering service company. So for the City of Galveston Beach surveys, we'll touch on briefly what we've gone through. So we've done the annual monitoring surveys in 2019, 2020, 2021, and 2022. We're just now wrapping up the analysis in the middle of the report for the 22 annual surveys. We did the post-storm survey in 2020, which is complex, to say the least. When you have storm sequencing of three storms and only one of them is declared a disaster, it's a travesty that we don't have better systems in place to manage that type of storm restoration efforts, storm monitoring efforts. But we work with what we have and have tried to come up with some of the best solutions to help with these engineered beaches that we have in Galveston. The depth of closure, this is how we have set up our surveys. It's pretty traditional. I believe this is what the City of Galveston Island has been doing since they started this back in 2013 or so. Beach berm surveys, beach-based surveys, nearshore wading depth, and then offshore surveys. We use a combination of the RTKs, the drones, traditional surveying, hydrographic surveying, and then use all that data. We have virtual monuments that we use to cross-check the data, do a QAQC, and then comparisons from year on year is just how we work that analysis. We'll touch on depth of closure probably a couple times in this presentation. It's an interesting concept. It's like a lot of things. If you ask 10 people what the depth of closure is, you'll get 15 different answers. So it's a very interesting approach. Our QAQC processes, we generally start with the upland RTK, then we work through the nearshore using the RTK and the GNSS, which is just the base stations that you have tied into the satellite work. And then we do the offshore, the hydrographic offshore with the boat work. And the way we do the QAQC on these projects is we do them separately in time on the same line, and then we have a minimum overlap between each of these three different types of surveys so that we can verify that we are meeting survey grade accuracies and horizontal and vertical components. And then with this all gets compiled into a single transect, and those transects are repeated year on year after storm so that we have a consistent data set that we can use to evaluate what the shoreline recession looks like, what the volume looks like. And in theory, we will be able to see what these sediment transport looks like. We can infer what that looks like with these comparison of the profiles along shore and offshore. And then for that, to historical data. And always the better data you have and the more data history you have, the better your predictions are going to be. And that's just a little plug for collecting as much data as possible as often as possible. There's just no getting around the benefits of good data collection, a good data collection program. For this particular slide, it's just showing the comparison of the different survey profiles that we've done. You can see in the 2022, we actually caught a part of the nourishment that was going on at the time. I believe that our survey was actually conducted while the nourishment was going on. So in some cases, we were moving our equipment around their equipment as we were doing these surveys, these annual surveys. And we have the report when it comes out, we have multiple maps that show, demonstrate what these look like. So it's pretty strong analysis. For the weighted depth surveys, we use, weighted depth is just what it sounds like. You go as far out into the water with your receiver until you get wetter, you start getting washed away. We have a maximum offset that we have on a transect that we're, I think it's less than 3 feet on a straight line, so that we have very consistent line and positioning as we're doing these profiles. The near shore and the offshore, it gets a little more complicated, but it's the same process as we make sure we do bar checks, make sure the system is in place collecting data accurately, and do the cross checks so that we can see the data in the field while we're collecting it looks good, and then we go through the post-processing to make sure that the data we're having and presenting is also accurate. The UAS data, the photogrammetry, this is a pretty interesting approach that we have where we can collect a wide swath of information, limited into a pretty narrow area. It works best on dry beach, open face, no vegetation, no wave action, no water, but you get a very wide data set collected very quickly and very accurately. Everyone has probably seen or heard of the drones and the drone piloting that goes on with these surveys that come out. It's a very effective tool that we have in our arsenal. It is certainly a tool in the toolbox that you can use and can be very effective when you're collecting these large-scale projects. Everything that you can look at in Galveston, you can collect very quickly and very accurately. The flight operations, the VLOS is one of the things to touch on here. This is where the visual line of sight, and this is part of the operation, the field operational checks that we do to make sure that the drone operators are where they're supposed to be collecting data, where they're supposed to be. The photos are processed with the RTK GNSS data, which is how we get it tied back into the near shore waiting depth surveys and offshore surveys. And then we end with ortho photos, point clouds, and the DEMs, the digital elevation models. This is an image of what we can collect off of the UAS surveys. So this is the drone flying the area. We can collect data up into the vegetation, the back bays, the buildings, the near shore, and then we actually can show visually where the breakers are and the water is. The data that comes out of here that is accurate is the flat beach face. We can see the parking lots, the buildings, and the beach face, but the vegetation causes its own problems with how you measure those elevations. So that is part of the post-processing that we go through in developing what these data sets look like. We included this picture in here because a unique piece of this project is how the stationing works. As we're going from the southwest to the northeast, we're increasing our transects from 1400 in this slide, 1400 station, 1400 to 1510, and then at the seawall it starts over again at 0+0, 0. So when you look through the reports and you see where there's some of these gaps in the transects, we're laying them out in the appropriate order. It's just the way that they were laid out were at different times, and just something to be aware of as you're looking through this, that the stationing that we have available, it is not necessarily tricky, but certainly need to pay attention to it in some cases for it to make sense. And again, this is just the imagery between what you collect with the drone surveys, where we can see the building elevations, we can see the beach base elevations, vegetation gets post-processed out. And these are the orthomosaics, puzzling all of the photogrammetry together, and then developing the digital elevation models, the DEMs for the projects. So it creates a very robust data set that we can use for doing our sort of volume calculations and the shoreline retreat calculations. And it's always a good way to look at the island. Like a lot of people, I enjoy just seeing and visualizing different data sets for Galveston. It's a pretty fascinating area. The results of the analysis, this is just a comparison of the volumes of how we did our calculations, looking at the profile-to-profile volume change using traditional civil calculation methods, the average in method, the shoreline changes. We're looking specifically at the mean high water line, the correlation between NABD 88, that is a geodetic datum that is used with the satellites. It's an approximation of the Earth's sphere. It provides a survey stability for consistent measurements, and then we translate that geodetic datum, NABD, North American Vertical Data 88, to the tidal datums. And in this case, I believe the offset from NABD 88, where the data was collected, to mean high water is 1.23 feet. So roughly, when we talk about NABD 88 as the datums, mean high water is just about a foot off of that. So it's pretty close. But it's important to note that when you're talking about the survey data, that the data that you collected in is important, and correlating it between the tidal datums and the geodetic datums is not necessarily confusing, but the distinction should be made of what we're speaking to. The edge of vegetation was collected, and then the changes in the dune. So this is what the maps look like. They're collecting data from the upland obstacles that we could find. When we run out of room on the upland side and we can't collect any more survey data, and then we push offshore down to the depth of closure, the contract is minus 24 feet is where we tend to collect data towards. We know that there is probably more sediment motion going on offshore of that, so in some cases we've actually pushed our surveys offshore to minus 27, minus 28 feet to collect a little bit more offshore data. But that is not consistent across the island. Generally it's between 24 and 25 feet is where most of the depth of closure surveys end, even historically, before Aptum started doing this process. Minus 30 feet is probably a better number to truly try and capture 100% of the sediment and the cross shore motion. Minus 30 feet is probably a more accurate, not necessarily a zero sum total of all the sediment, cross shore sediment change, volume change, but it gets to near asymptotic out around that direction until you get to the very large storms that push that kind of sediment around that far offshore. Just needed to be noted that, again, the depth of closure is a concept that's a mathematical construct, and depending on how you want to construct that information, it has different purposes. Depth of closure for the city of Galveston Island should very likely be considered in terms of FEMA. And FEMA has a zero sediment motion at the depth of closure. That's pretty much what their standard is. And you capture the vast majority of that sediment if you go out a little bit further. And I believe the city's probably aware of it. I don't know the park board's aware of it.
Can you say that in English, please?
As the big, so the question was, can I repeat that with a little less jargon? when you have large storms roll in, you have storm surge, you have large waves that come in with that storm surge. The wave energy that touches the bottom that creates the waves has a deconstructive force that moves sediment offshore and it moves it along shore, depending on where the currents are. And FEMA is interested in how much of that material is getting moved offshore by that wave energy. And the further offshore you go, the less sediment motion you have based on those large waves. But it's a statistical construct where the larger your waves, the more offshore you're going to have to go to capture all that sediment motion. And with the larger storms that we're having, more intense storms we're having, we're seeing motion further offshore now. So in order to capture a more accurate representation of what that sediment motion is offshore as a result of the storms and the storm waves, we need to look just a little bit further offshore. So instead of looking at minus 25 feet depth, we can see some material being pushed out to the almost a minus 30 where we're still seeing some sediment change. But we weren't looking very closely out there. It's
yeah, all right, so you're going from 25 feet out to 30 feet, and at this flat angle, how many feet is that average out?
It's a great question. A few thousand feet in some cases, depending on the slope. It can be significant. It can add significant transect line miles to a project, to a large scale project.
Yeah, and that would increase the cost with surveys.
Yes. The more line miles that you run, the more expensive it's going to be.
I guess, but why this is all important,
that's
what he's telling us, is that's the way we know how much sand we put down in a project, and if it's still in system within the depth of closure, then FEMA says theoretically it has a chance to come back to the beach, and so they look for the net, the loss between what we put down on the beach and what they find after they do the survey each year, and after a storm in particular, and that's breaking it way down simplistically.
That's exactly correct, though.
But
so
it's the net. We're looking at
the interest
net
that we have. It's a very small percentage. We did an analysis, post-storm analysis, on what the transects that we had available to a depth that was further offshore than minus 24 feet, and we're capturing 99% of the sediment is above roughly minus 27 foot depth,
right,
offshore depth. But FEMA can, if they wanted to be letter of the law and they wanted to hold feet, they could say we want to capture all of it. There's an argument to be made that if you're capturing statistically 90-95%, you're doing a very good job of understanding what's going on in the system, and it becomes less of an issue the more that you can get closer to 100%.
All right, has FEMA indicated which way they're going to go?
I have not heard. I know that I believe I should say that they're reviewing the analysis that we've done.
That's accurate.
And again, that's the FEMA discussion is slightly an aside from what we're trying to do with the beach survey work. The depth of closure discussion is really about understanding how the system works on Galveston Island. It doesn't take much to really understand that the more data you have, the better you're going to be. And the difference of the expense of going a little bit further offshore is that you have less problems with FEMA. It doesn't take 2.5 years to get an answer from FEMA when you can demonstrate immediately that you've captured all the data accurately.
Yeah, but if you can establish that 99% is good enough, you don't have to do all that.
That's right. One of the, and I'll say anecdotally, the more published papers that you can point to that have hard science involved that demonstrate that there is a depth of closure that is an assignment of depth of closure to a location, the stronger your argument is. And part of our research into the depth of closure for Galveston Island, we talked to a lot of people. We talked to Texas A&M Galveston professors. We've talked to people that have done surveys on the island before. And ask the question, what have you determined your depth of closure to be? And if we talk to five people, we got five different answers. So it's close. It's a narrow window, but it's still a bit of an unknown.
For clarification, when John asks those questions about sediment transport, he's also trying to figure out where to catch a break. He's a surfer.
Absolutely. So coastal engineers actually develop a surf similarity parameter that we can put on any project to demonstrate how well our waves will break. So we can talk about what that design might look like on future projects. So the resultant analysis, I'll point out here again, the survey limit station to station, when you go for Delano Beach, it goes from 1470 plus 00 to 20 plus 00. That is because we're making that turn at 1500 to 1510, and then it goes back to zero at the seawall. So the Delano Beach is actually going from, the station numbering is from 1400 at the southeast side to plus 20 on the northeast side. And then the shoreline change, it's the same. We're looking here at mean high water, that's the shoreline motion. So at mean high water, the shoreline change, that is the rate of change at mean high water based on this analysis.
The change in how much beach we have, the change in how much sand,
location.
Distance.
So it is the distance per year that the shoreline is changing at mean high water.
Changing, like getting higher, getting lower, farther
correct.
From the dune, closer from to the dune.
Minus 14, the negative numbers are a retreat, so it is moving landward, and the positive numbers are that it is moving further offshore.
Oh, a couple questions around that. So it's always interesting to me how you measure the mean high tide when the beach is changing all the time. Can you dig a little bit into that and just explain it in layman's terms? Because it seems like it would be very, very difficult.
It's one of those conceptual concepts that we have to have. We have to have a place to have a discussion, and on an ephemeral beach face, the beach face specifically, the near shore wave action area, is one of those places that's extremely dynamic. And if you look into the regulations for the state of Texas, the line of vegetation is mentioned several times. It's one of the things that we will map. That is also an extremely nebulous location in space. So we use mean high water as a statistical term that's based on a history of analysis of the means of the recorded tidal elevations. So in a diurnal, you have a mean high or high, a mean high, mean low, and a mean low or low. And that is generally the range of tidal statistics that you'll look at that is truly just taking 20 years, 30 years, 40 years of data and then running a statistical analysis to determine what those elevations are. And those tidal elevations give us a common place to speak to. So when we speak directly to mean high water, that is a statistical number that was determined and is recorded by NOAA on the tide stations. Those numbers can fluctuate depending on how recently that statistical analysis has been done. So generally, when we're interested in finding a more accurate representation of mean high water, we would do a statistical analysis of all data available ourselves. And see how close that actually resides to the reported numbers. And I don't mean to go too far off the rails, but to answer the question, the tidal datums themselves are statistical averages, and we use them so that we have something to talk to directly. And it's the difference between the geodetic datum of the North American vertical datum of 1988, which is a fixed geodetic datum. And then we can then do offsets of where the tidal datums are, mean high water are, compared to that. So all the surveys will be collected in NAV 88 and then shifted down to the tidal datums based on an agreed upon interval between those two operations.
But it's a real number.
Yes.
It's an information. Yeah, it's not a concept. It's calculated is conceptual, but they're taking real data from where on average is the mean high.
Right.
It's
like 17 years, you go back 17 or 18, what is the exact years of statistical data? I know there's a specific.
So
you said 30, it could be 30, but I thought it was like more like 17.
If you have data available for 100 years, you can get a very good, accurate representation of what it is. Right. The way that the NOAA tide stations work, they do it in epochs, and they have 20-year epochs. And the last one was 1981 to 2001, I believe. And it is time for that analysis to be re-upped, to reassigned, to do the mathematics again. but we're still using the reported data by NOAA on the tide gauges along the Texas coast, technically across Gulf of Mexico and the United States coast. NOAA collects that information, they do the statistics, and they have a reported number for what your tidal datum elevations are relative to each other and relative to NABD 88. So when we collect that number, and Mike, if you're on the line, please help me if I'm floundering over here.
No, I have a pretty good idea. I just wanted you to elaborate a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we
agree. It's definitely a real number based on statistics, and it's the one that we're using now to talk about what mean how water elevation is. If we wanted to have better information, we would take a much longer analysis, and we would do it ourselves, and that would be very specific to our report. It would not be something that we would report nationally. It would be something that we could hand to NOAA and say, this is what our analysis looked like. Do you agree? And they would go through their own analysis themselves.
I understand. Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Any other questions regarding
yes.
that last slide?
Yeah, I have a question. Can you go back to that last slide?
Of course we have another question.
So what is your thoughts on, I mean, it says historic seawall beach, we have almost a million cubic yards of volume change, but then that's got 14 feet of shoreline change. If we got more sand up there, is that bringing in a beach nourishment probably?
So the beach nourishment project, the large scale beach nourishment project was ongoing at the time that we were doing this annual survey. So. Yes, please.
Sorry to interrupt. The historic seawall beach, the nourishment that was going on while they were doing the survey was BABES, not historic, just to be clear.
Thank you.
So.
Material that's placed is moving offshore.
Yeah, correct.
So you have a rotation. Generally, the way that beach nourishments work, you have a beach profile template that's laid out. And for those of you, I'm waving my hands around. You have a beach profile that gets put in place, and that ends up shifting as it flattens out, so that you end up with a thicker beach. But you will lose dry beach width, even though you keep the same total volume in your littoral system inside of your sediment motion envelope from your design beach width. If it's 100 feet, over time you will have less and less dry beach width, even though you have the same amount of volume on the same profile. It's the equilibrium profile that it is finding tends to be further offshore. Yes. So it tends towards the existing natural beach face geometry.
Well, the beach is still pretty wide.
I'm just asking the question because it seems like it's counterintuitive if you have more. I understand. Yeah.
So it's a great question, though, and again, I don't mean to be to have too much obfuscation in it, but the way that you get a more holistic understanding of what's going on with your shoreline erosion rates is you look at it at a +4, +5 mean sea level, and a -4, -5, and then something offshore, so that you're then collecting multiple data points to see what is actually moving inside of that structure, the coastal infrastructure. Your soft beach nourishment is a coastal structure.
So the net take home is if we didn't do this beach re-nourishment, we are in a negative sediment system. We're in the fastest disappearing place in the United States between the boot of Louisiana and the upper Texas coast. So if you don't do beach renourishment, that -14-foot retreat would be much bigger, but it's like cash flow. Like, you might have a lot of cash flow, you might have $2 million in cash flow, but you might only have $200 in the bank. But the point is the cash flow. But this diagram doesn't really show the net. It's not comparing these points prior to the beach renourishment, where that negative number might have been -50.
That's right. And
so that's why it's hard to read, because there's not a baseline comparison.
That's right. So that material is still in system, but they typically lay, Gerald, like a 300-foot template, and the those that surf know, everybody bitches, the brakes are gone, but in 6 months' time or so, that dry beach narrows to about 150 feet, which is kind of our normalized template, and then the bars have come back and formed themselves, and then it's a more natural system, and they must have hit it just spot on. The material's still in system, and the shoreline has naturalized, and that's when this was taken. And with Bates, you can see they were in the fast, big middle of putting the beach down, and so it's got the 50-foot gain there.
And to be clear to Rhonda and Chris's points, that we talk a lot about depth of closure. Depth of closure is only taken on our engineer beaches. So that's why you're seeing those three specific locations in Chris's presentation, because those are where the depth of closure is taken. The depth of closure surveys are our insurance policy with FEMA when we have beach claims and beach loss because of storms. So they are, this APTIM does not take depth of closure island-wide, but they do wading depth island-wide annually.
We should also be clear here that this is, the numbers here are the annual surveys from 21 to 22. So this is just what we saw from the last survey that we did last summer to this most recent 2022 survey. And to get an accurate understanding of what's going on over time, we should be looking at these shoreline erosion rates over time, so that we would have 1942 data all the way through 2022 data, what the shoreline erosion rates look like, and then you could put that on a graph, and you could see what your erosion rates really, and I'll go the other way, but that you can see that your erosion rates are actually, it's knowable. This is a snapshot of the two times that we collected data for the 2021 survey and the 2022 survey, and that those two data sets were compared to each other to derive this simplistic information. We in the report, we actually talked to mean higher high water, mean lower low water, the edge of vegetation is all collected and provided in the report. So this is just a synopsis of what that data is.
Is there a significant difference between east and west of beaches that are creating as the, when you're walking out, you're talking about doing the depth surveys. Is there a big difference in how fast, if it gets deeper faster on the east end or on the west end? Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay.
I'll see if Mike wants to answer that question before I jump in.
Come
on, Mike.
It's interesting. Just wondering how the sand affects.
He's ghosting me.
No, the island is relatively uniform in the slope. Like Chris said, that we only do depth of closure surveys within the engineer beaches. So our data only extends to about zero or negative one for the non-engineered beaches, but from the berm face, that the slope is relatively consistent. I would agree with that, Chris, absolutely.
Idea surveys for engineered beaches on Galveston only? Or do you have other surveys on Galveston?
We are only comparing our surveys. Our depth of closure surveys were for the engineered beaches, and then for the remainder of the island, we did wading depth and upland surveys. For the entire island, except for the upland areas with private property that we did go on to, and for the state park that we did not collect data. I believe that's a correct statement.
And Jamaica Beach.
But on average, they would be very similar because the distance
they get all the benefits and none of the buy-in. It's holistically, coastal engineering works better in long systems. The bigger the project, the better the project. When you're doing beach nourishment, the longer your project is, the more stable it's going to be over a longer term. That's just the basis of it. So doing a 100-foot long beach nourishment project doesn't make sense. Doing a 5-mile long beach nourishment project is a great way to do beach nourishment.
Do we have any other questions or comments for Afton?
Well, I just had a question. The survey you've done, you did for the city?
Yes, it was a contract with the city in partnership
and
with the park.
What was the overall cost?
I think annually, currently, the partnership, the park board's paying for the depth of closure surveys, and the city is paying for the rest, the waiting depth surveys. I know that the park board's portion is about $55,000 a year. I can't speak, I don't remember the contract number. Russell, do you remember what it is? Probably another $30,000, maybe.
I don't know the answer to that question, but I can find out. That's a normal answer.
We can share that information.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just under $100,000 for the entire thing.
First one and the last one, we had waiting depth surveys with RTK systems and not just the aerial UAS.
And so y'all are just doing transects, y'all aren't doing the entire beach.
We're doing transects
on the engineer beach.
At the engineer beaches,
mm-hmm.
And then we're collecting the photogrammetry, the ortho mosaics for everywhere else.
And Mr. McCall, the cost for any kind of post-storm survey like happened in 2020, that's an additional cost for them to come in and hit the beach after a storm.
Okay. Yes.
Just, I'm over the moon that we are sustaining a scientific approach to look at our beaches, which none are accreting. We all need to really realize that we are more like fortressing or buttressing what we have through human beneficial uses. There is no positive sediment flow into our system. So if a beach looks like it's accreting, that's just our human history of 10 years seeing it build, but it doesn't mean over 50 years that beach is building unless we keep renourishing, because there's no sediments coming into the system yet the way they would have historically from the Mississippi River.
I thought that the far east and far west has accretion.
Well, it's just, it's accretion in a small place, but if you take the total number, there's no accretion. Only through
the sand wouldn't be available to accrete there if it wasn't put into the system manually.
I understand. Yeah. Okay.
It's the littoral drift that is taking it to the end.
Right.
That's
what I
was
thought.
That it's accreting.
Okay.
So it's like just a human, like,
I understand. That
makes
sense.
Perception that it's
accreting.
Growing naturally.
Correct. So is this data used to identify future locations for nourishment or the need to nourish? Oh, this one?
Sure.
Honestly, you know, when ERDC did the sand management plan, that was a definite study, a very large scale study that addressed and identified areas for Galveston to look at, but typically no. We know that the highest rate of erosion is right at the end of the seawall and at Dellinera, and we're hitting the beach right now. I'll give an update during the updates on the nourishment that's happening, but you know, unfortunately for Galveston, we nourish the beaches as a response to storm activity. We haven't gotten in a position, maybe monetarily and or sand sourcing, to nourish the beaches just as a means of maintaining the beaches, which would be optimum.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Cheryl. Well, thank you, everybody. Good questions, great comments. I always learn more at these committee meetings than I feel like I do of the other 6-7 days out of the week. Thank you, Chris, for that presentation.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. If you have questions through Cheryl, through the city, or contact us, I appreciate your time today.
Sir, thank you.
on before or after the meeting. All right, everybody, my name is Kelsey. I am the Outreach and Marketing Coordinator for Artist Vote. And this is a big project that we do with the Park Board every year, is the World Ocean Day Festival. For those of you that might not know, World Ocean Day is a United Nations recognized international holiday that's celebrated in over 150 countries. And it's a day where they hope to celebrate, learn about, and do their part to help the oceans. So here in Galveston, our World Ocean Day Festival is over at East Beach. And we host a lot of exhibitors. Last year we had 18 exhibitors. We had five vendors. We have an entertainment stage where last year we had somebody that was singing songs about recycling. We had a ukulele group. So we have a series of entertainment on stage. And then we also had workshop tents where we had five different workshops that people could participate in, ranging from a drum circle to watercolor painting of wildlife. So all different art or music related activities. And then we do our Bucket Brigade tours. We do those throughout the summer, but at this event, we do host four tours for people to go and explore the beaches and learn more about how unique Galveston beaches are. And then the Beautify the Bucket is a annual art competition that we do. I'm sure you guys have seen the painted trash barrels out on the beaches there. So we host the award ceremony at the World Ocean Day, and that's also where all of the newly painted ones are on display for people to come and check out the new ones. And then of course, thousands of beach visitors. So these are some of our past exhibitors and sponsors. As I said, last year we had roughly 20 exhibitors. And unfortunately no sponsors last year, but we are hoping to expand, so we're going to be reaching out to a lot more people to try and get them to be exhibitors and sponsors, and we're also going to begin that process much earlier this year to try and have more people get asked and, you know, get them to us before they end up at another activity. So this is more on that Beautify the Bucket. It allows people to take an active role in beautifying our beaches in Galveston and helps encourage proper use of trash receptacles because since they're so beautiful, people notice them more and that encourages them to use them. So these are the statistics from past years. We started doing this competition in 2016. And then it grew up until COVID, and unfortunately we weren't able to get those ones painted. And then this coming year, we're hoping to do at least 120 barrels.
I thought in 2020, 121 were adopted. Most were painted.
Were they?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Just like 20 people never brought the barrels back.
Okay. And then this is our statistics from participation in past years for the festival itself. So as you can see, that one grew every year until COVID. Unfortunately, we had to cancel that one that year. But this past year was the biggest one that we've done yet, and hopefully we will make it even bigger this year with some of these expansions that we're hoping to add. So we would like to add at the festival a food truck from Lighthouse Charity that will have sustainable seafood tacos. We would like to do something with the volleyball complex that's right next to the festival, so maybe some sort of tournament or something like that. With the Beautify the Bucket, as I mentioned, we're going to be doing more barrels and opening registration earlier. And then we're going to add some more signage at the beach to try and direct more people that are just at the beach that day over towards us. We'll be getting some t-shirts that are made from recycled materials that people could take home with them as a souvenir from the World Ocean Day. And we have lots of partners from nature organizations that have ambassador animals. So we would love to get an air-controlled area so that they're able to bring those ambassador animals, because the beach is unfortunately too hot for people to bring a lot of their furry friends. So we want them to be able to bring those. And then, as I mentioned at the very beginning, we want to make it into a 4-day series of events rather than just the festival itself. So starting on the 8th, we would start with things like trash pickups in areas that are not tended around the Galveston, because of course the park board does such a great job of picking up trash now. and then we want to add a series of vessel and field events with partners throughout the community. So try and get them on more excursions and nature events throughout Galveston. So spreading it throughout town, not just focusing on that one beach. And then we would like to add a luncheon as well to present an award to somebody that is a national hero for our oceans. So that would be a luncheon at the Ashton Villa, hopefully. That would be for about 50 people. So this was actually our 2022 budget. Sorry, I didn't make an updated one of this. So I'm going to talk to you more about the additions that I just spoke about being added into this cost. So the film screening that we wanted to add would be over at the Sea Star base. That one would be about $5,000 added for that. The Ocean Action Hero Award luncheon would add about $7,000. And then this one also doesn't reflect the workshop tents that we added. So this is just the rental of that main tent. So those workshop tents are also a significant cost. So for the next year, we roughly estimated that it would come to about 40,000 because it has extra days and a much bigger event. Anybody have any questions?
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Any questions or comments for Artist Boat? It's a great event. As you can see by the number I've seen, it's grown every year. I'm a supportive of adding some additional days and trying to span it over 3 or 4 days versus 1 day.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions or comments? Yes, Elizabeth, and then Jim.
Are we having a table or booth again?
Yes.
That would be something we would discuss in the future. I think it may be on our work plan, but I would assume if it's possible, we would want to have another.
That's our intent,
yes. The tent that we have, if we have more than we had last year, then we need a double tent or something like that, because some people, like, we put our booths behind other booths so that the other exhibitors could have space. Like, we were, I would say, at maximum capacity last year under quite a large tent. And then
historically, the last couple of years, BMAC has had a booth
mm-hmm.
at Old Ocean. Volunteers here at the table to try to manage an hour, 2 hours throughout the day.
Yeah, and we hope the booths are hands-on activities. Like, gosh, if we could have an activity that explains this depth of closure concept, I'm like, why do we do a project and sit bench about depth of closure?
We could have an importance of beach nourishment. Maybe,
yeah, I mean, we hope that the booth will be geeking out.
So maybe Acton can buy it, is what you're saying?
Oh, yeah.
We did that last year. Our table at Acton's was about sediment, period,
yeah.
And how sediment works in the beach system. And we did have a little pretend nourishment in a pan.
Yeah.
And we showed ocean activity and erosion and what breakwater and plant structures. I mean, and
yeah.
Be surprised, kids have a lot better concepts of it than many adults. And one, we had sand from up and down the coast and bought different parcels of sand from different beaches. And I had one little girl explain to me the clay content in the different samples she saw. So, you know, kids have got some really good conceptual, good concepts about our coastline and what's going on. But our theme was sediments. You know, we looked at coastal sediments, so it was cool. So we did do a little beach.
And lots of families. The point is to get people, all ages,
mm-hmm.
what we call K through grade, and then
know, we hope to get people more, what we would say, on the water, out doing things up to the day of the festival. And, you know, it's the weekend right after school gets out, so it's a little bit slower, so there's room for more visitors on island around this time period, too. It's not the peak of summer remotely.
You said you wanted to expand more on the island. Who were you thinking? Did you contact the state park? Because I can give you the ranger name out there.
That would be excellent.
And they do on Saturdays beach and bay walks with the help of the Galveston Bay Region Master Naturalist. And that would fit right in with that if you expanded.
The partner organizations would do their activities on Thursday, Friday, and Sunday, and we would push people to the festival
on
Saturday. But we have contacted Kyle. The state park has had a booth in the past with Master Naturalist. I don't believe they came last year.
The state park did not.
Yeah, because they were in the middle of that big
renovation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the Master Naturalist have come many times, and then so we hope to build a series of events and then kind of have a flyer or something where people know to contact those organizations directly. We don't plan on doing registration for like the Seagull or whoever. The year of COVID, we had 5 partner sites lined up, and the universe shut down.
Well, I do know that in June, that first week, the Master Naturalist and that told Camp Wild. So I know a lot of their members are busy between the 6th and the 9th, because they do a camp for the children of 3rd and 4th and 5th graders.
Mm-hmm.
So they're pretty busy there, but that's...
Yeah, the whole world is always busy, it appears. But
yeah.
We did have a lot of partners. But like Guido's could come have a booth and talk about like fisheries or how to prepare fish. Like we really would like hands-on things. I know there's issues with
cool.
booths, but we'll meet with the park board many times and sort these things out. But we hope to teach people about all the components of the ocean, not just how, like, we steward the ocean through our actions, how we treat the beach. But we also steward the ocean in many ways by how we purchase seafood, by what products we wear, how we reuse bottles, stuff like that. So we hope to expand it more into, like, actions are not just what you do the day you come to the beach. They're actions you do all year, whether you live in Dallas or Seattle or Galveston.
And Carla and Kelsey, if we had an organization or a company who wanted to sponsor a booth, how would they go about doing that?
Oh, we'll have forms online, and then we have vendor forms and exhibit that it's free for nonprofits or governmental agencies. And then if somebody's selling something or versus like, if they're not a nonprofit, it's all, the fees are small.
Okay, great.
And we hope to get sponsors for different parts of the, you know, like somebody would sponsor the stage or a workshop tent or a musical performance, things like that.
How are the hotels and restaurants helping promote this event earlier in the week?
Well, I mean, most places in town are putting up posters for us or letting us put out pushcards. I don't know that like they're including us in newsletters or anything like that. And then the park board does a lot of promotion on their, they have bigger social media challenges than us. And then I don't know who, last year the woman came from the Houston Chronicle and did a live piece on the Beautify the Bucket judging. And also, if anybody wants to be a judge, now's the time to tell Kelsey, because it's hard work and we usually need about 8 judges. And it's hard work, I just have to say. It takes about 2 hours to go through the barrels and score them. And so if anybody wants to be a judge, we have a little rubric. You don't have to decide a lot other than based on the rubric, but please let us know, because that's super fun to be a judge.
Carl, when I was talking about promoting, it would be almost if someone was checking into a hotel, that's the first week kids are out, there are going to be a lot of kids coming to the island. You know, parents are always looking for stuff to do. Is it something that the hotel or hotelier can hand to the guests and say, here, this is the festival tomorrow, or this is the festival on Saturday? You know, just something in hand.
Yeah, we do try to get the hotels to have all the information. Some won't put up posters, some won't take pushcards, some don't have concierge, so it gets really varied to try to communicate with them all.
Sure.
But like, San Luis, they seem to be better at like telling guests what to do versus like the Motel 6 or whatever. But
there were still parks. I mean, we're at the surf shop on 61st and Seawall. It's the busiest intersection. People are always coming in and they're always asking, you know, what is there to do? I mean, if there was a car or something.
So we always get push cars. Now, we are a staff of 14 people and one person to go to all these places. So if you, yeah, I mean, just if you can give Kelsey your name, address, then that's how we build a list. We have 850 places we drop stuff off at.
Could some push cards be brought to the next BMAC meeting?
Once they're produced, I'd be happy to provide
them. Yeah, we could probably.
What a meeting before.
Well, I think we're hoping to get the push cards in March, late March.
March is when we would start advertising.
So.
Because I think folks here would probably like to distribute them. So that
All right. We have this on our work plan for March to get an update and discuss.
Oh, okay.
Perfect. Yeah.
That was a good introduction. I know last year we did have a push to get things out on marquees, and it seemed like that worked out well. I know quite a few restaurants on the seawall had that up. We'll dig more into this in March.
Yeah, and I don't know how it wound up on the marquees.
I thought we talked about it in here, but
maybe Melody asked them.
Could be.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, great stuff. Any other questions, comments? Thank you for that presentation.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And moving right along to item 10, I believe is where we're at. I think it's an update from Hal. Presentation on tropical weather recap for 2022. We have Dr. Hal Needham here today.
Hey y'all, this is a pretty fast-paced presentation on our tropical weather review, so we'll hop to it, looking back at last tropical season and a lot about just weather communication in general that I think you'll find applicable. So Phil Klosbach, a friend of mine and one of the world's most famous hurricane scientists, we were on a video call a couple weeks ago. He said the 2022 Atlantic hurricane season was one of the most usual seasons ever. Well, what did he mean by that? Well, in some ways, it was a very usual season. We had 14 named storms, 8 hurricanes, and 2 major hurricanes. It's very close to the third-year average of 14, 7, and 3. But to a lot of people, it felt really, really slow. And one reason for that is that it followed the hyperactive seasons of 2020 and 2021. 2020 was the busiest season on record since we began records in 1851. We had 30 named storms in 2020. 21 storms in 2021. So we had 51 named storms, the highest we ever had in a 2-year period for 2020 and 2021. So comparatively, last year felt really slow. We were used to like 7 named storms by the time we got to mid-July. But there's some other weird things that happened last year. Really right during the heart of hurricane season, July 4th to August 31st, no named storms at all for like 7 weeks. It was crazy. People were just flocking down. They were out on the stand-up paddleboard saying, hey, I don't have to look behind me. I'm not going to get blindsided by a hurricane. It was a little bit crazy. I mean, comparing that, like, for example, a silent August without a named storm in the basin, it's only happened 4 other times, in 1997, 1961, 41, and 29. So this was pretty rare to see it that quiet for that long in the heart of what we expected to be a very active hurricane season. So why was it so inactive for so long? The Washington Post, they interviewed a lot of really prominent hurricane scientists. One of the main reasons was just really losing what we call the instability. So this is a graphic. Could I actually, I don't know if, I can't quite see the top there. I think it's probably okay. At the top, the title there just says that really we lost a lot of instability. This is a graphic of showing instability through the season. So instability, this is just those convective thunderstorms firing up in the basin where we get the moisture, a lot of thunderstorms basin-wide. really compared to average, we were losing a lot of that instability in the basin. So we didn't really see those clusters of thunderstorms firing, especially in mid-summer. And one of the reasons for that was actually the Sahara air layer. So we see a lot of the Sahara dust coming, this dry air coming off the coast of Africa. I don't know if you knew this, but we have the Hurricane Hunter planes that fly into hurricanes. They went farther east than they'd ever gone before. I actually did an interview with a Hurricane Hunter pilot. They went all the way to the Cape Verde Islands to measure some of this dust and see what was going on. But we think some of this dust coming off of Africa really was prominent. It can travel all the way to the Caribbean and even to the Gulf of Mexico. Sometimes we'll see kind of a milky white sunset here in the summer. That can be Sahara air and dust coming all the way from Africa to us here in Galveston. And that will really produce a dry layer that really knocks down a lot of these tropical cyclones. So it's something we're studying and understanding better. But with other things, this was one of the main reasons we saw a lot of inactivity kind of mid-season last year. This is a map of the hurricanes and tropical storms and major hurricanes last year. You can see we had 14 named storms. And a lot of these tracks were displaced farther to the east than normal, but we kind of expected that. And so there's something called the North Atlantic Oscillation. This just really has to do with pressure patterns in the Atlantic. When we see the May-June average as positive, typically when that happens, the Bermuda High, which kind of blocks a lot of these storms and steers these storms, it tends to be a stronger high, but farther off to the east. It allows a lot of these hurricanes and tropical storms to kind of track farther east. A lot of fish storms in the Atlantic, or storms along the eastern seaboard, but not as much in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's what we had last year. We had a positive North Atlantic oscillation phase. Comparatively, if we have a negative phase, that's when we see the Bermuda High shifted farther towards the west and more of these hurricane tracks towards us. So we saw a positive index last year, and we were kind of expecting more eastward tracking storms. So again, that's kind of what we saw last year, and in a way, that's kind of what we expected. So looking at one of the controls on how many hurricanes we see in the Atlantic actually has to do with the equatorial Pacific water temperatures. If you've heard of El Nino and La Nina, this is a graph showing 1982 to present. And you can see over the last 3 years, you see a lot of blue on that graphic. That means we've been in a La Nina. When we have a La Nina, those equatorial Pacific waters are cold. It typically means that we see more active hurricane seasons in the Atlantic. And that has to do with less wind shear, less crosswinds knocking down these hurricanes. So, and that really fits. The last 3 years, we had two hyperactive seasons and then one average season. So in general, where you see blue, you're gonna have more activity. We've been in a La Nina, we're still in a La Nina, but the good news with a sneak peek looking towards next season, this is from Columbia University. Right now, you see these are 3 month segments. So right now we're in DJF, December, January, February. We're still in a La Nina, but the forecast shifts us through this spring and into next summer going towards El Nino. I have where I have HS for hurricane season, that's next August, September, October. The models are suggesting we'll be in the El Nino by then. In general, that would mean less hurricane activity in the Atlantic, which is good news for us. But again, all this stuff, counting these storms, talking about how many storms are out there, you know, the mantra, and it really held true last year, of it only takes one. You hear people say that a lot. What they mean is we could have a hurricane season with six named storms, but if one of those named storms is a Cat 3 hurricane at Galveston Island, for us, it was a catastrophic season, even if we didn't have 20 storms in the basin. So last year, people were saying this a lot because we had a major hurricane come in, Southwest Florida Hurricane Ian in late September. I was on the ground for about 10 days before, during, and after the storm. It was absolutely devastating. I have a lot of video footage. Where I was, we had sustained winds in the low 130s, gusts in the 150s, a very catastrophic storm, and unfortunately a very deadly storm. And so I want to really focus the rest of this presentation on what I learned about communicating. Last year was really the year that I learned a lot about how to improve science communication related to disasters, but also just weather along the coastline. And there are three main things that I learned that we really have, that where we have a lot of miscommunication. And unfortunately, people are getting blindsided, and it can even be fatal. The first problem is something called anchoring. So this is the hurricane track 5 days before Ian made landfall. You can see where I put the yellow star in Fort Myers Beach. That's where we had a lot of fatalities. But this was the track forecast about 5 days before. You can see it was forecast to track farther to the west, actually pass west of Tampa, maybe make landfall somewhere around Apalachee Bay or north central Florida. But you can see how this shifted. This is a Sunday morning forecast.
This is a Tuesday morning forecast, and you can see that there's a big shift there where it actually shifted east of Tampa and right towards Fort Myers. What happens is a lot of times people see something like this and say, oh, I'm outside the cone. This is going to be west of Tampa. I looked at the forecast. We're going to be good. We don't have to worry about this. And then all of a sudden, there can be a major shift like this where Fort Myers Beach is right in the eye wall of a major hurricane. But a lot of people have already checked out. A lot of people have said, I'm not going to worry about this one. I saw a previous map. And they kind of anchor with that early forecast. And so what I learned with communicating science with high level of uncertainty, this was a storm where the meteorologists were saying all along that the models were conflicting, that we can expect some large shifts in the track. There was a lot of disagreement in the models. And so we should not have been too surprised to see a big shift like this. What I learned in these types of weather events where there's a lot of uncertainty, we have to communicate to the audience that this is fluid and dynamic, expect changes to the forecast, and please stay tuned for updates. So it's really on the coastal resident to make sure that they're staying tuned and that they're expecting there to be changes. A lot of times people anchor on that first message they hear and they're not ready for changes. So that's one thing that I really learned this last year is anchoring is an issue. Another issue are what I call eye-centric forecasts. So this is pretty much the classic hurricane track forecast that we're used to seeing from the Hurricane Center. It's showing basically a cone which gets wider through time of potential really eye positions, or as I circled up there, the storm center. So this is really showing the probable path for the storm center. And we're so used to seeing these types of graphics from the Hurricane Center, but also from meteorologists on TV, right? We're just used to seeing the hurricane symbol with a line and a cone, and we're all wondering, where is this storm gonna go? What we're really showing in these graphics is where are we predicting the eye of the storm to be? And so even right here, they've trademarked eye path. They're forecasting here the eye path, and it implies the closer you are to the eye, the greater your danger. But that's actually not really true much of the time. And so there are three main problems with these eye-centric forecasts. Number one, they imply the closer you are to the eye, the higher the risk. Storm surge is very often lopsided to the right, with much higher surges really far to the right of the eye. The eye is almost the farthest left periphery with both storm surge and heavy rainfall. Here are some maps. I run USURGE, the International Coastal Flood Database, and this is a map of Hurricane Katrina. You can see here Katrina came in as a major hurricane here in South Louisiana, and you can see here where the eye came in really right around New Orleans and really very close to the Louisiana-Mississippi border. But look at, as you go 80, 100, 120 miles to the right of the eye track, you're still seeing 16 feet of water all along the Mississippi coast, even 12 to 16 feet of water in Alabama. And it really drops off quickly if you go to the left. 3 weeks after Katrina, we know Hurricane Rita, obviously with a big issue here with evacuation. This was the track of Rita. And look at this, look at where it makes landfall, right around the Louisiana-Texas border. You go 85, 90 miles to the west. Here in Galveston, we have, 3 to 4 feet of storm surge, really a non-event. Go that far to the east, and you're looking at 12 to 16 feet of storm surge in Vermilion Bay. So very lopsided, you can almost see where the eye is almost the farthest left periphery of the really catastrophic damage. These storms are very lopsided, and the eye doesn't really tell the story. Same thing with heavy rainfall. I lived through Hurricane Isaac in 2012, I was in Baton Rouge. The eye passed very close to where I lived, and we didn't really get terrible rainfall, but really offset far to the right, to the east there. Tremendous rains in southeast Louisiana, all the way over through Mississippi. 100 miles east of the eye, you were getting terrible rains. 20, 30 miles to the west, you were getting hardly anything. Very, very lopsided. And again, Hurricane Florence here, 2018 in the Carolinas, same story. Almost all this heavy rain is far to the right of the eye track. And so this becomes an issue because when you're looking at this, yeah. I forgot, yeah, I wish I'd love to show Ike as well. I have tons of these maps. If you want data or maps on a specific storm, I can show you. But Ike as well, a big time surge all the way through South Louisiana, even over towards Southeast Louisiana. Yeah, very, very lopsided. So imagine though, if you're just thinking about these eye tracks, and imagine if the track actually, now again, with the cone, we're saying we expect the eye could travel really in any area in this cone. Imagine if you have an actual hurricane track that stays far to the left on this cone. And again, the impacts are offset far to the right. So a lot of your impacts are right there in the cone, and not as many people are surprised. But with a storm like Ian, this storm hugs the right part of the cone, and a lot of these deadly impacts where people are dying are outside of the cone. Because again, and a lot of meteorologists will say, actually, this forecast was accurate. It stayed within the cone. The eye stayed within the cone, but these massive storm surge and wind impacts, a lot of that was outside the cone. And that's my concern with these eye-centric forecasts. Most of the catastrophic impacts may be outside of the cone of uncertainty. A substantial number of residents are blindsided when wind and water is outside. These are all with like right tracking storms. And a lot of your science geeks will say, hey, the cone did its job. People just misunderstood it. Well, unfortunately, in these cases, a lot of the people that misunderstood it, there could be fatalities. So finally, anchoring eye-centric forecast and then poor word choice and not being descriptive enough. That was a lesson I myself learned. A lot of times we're out there giving feet of water, we're talking about storm surge ranges, but we need to be more descriptive. This is a hard graphic for me to look at. This is a guy named Mitch Pakinon. He was called the mayor of Fort Myers Beach. He wasn't the official mayor, just everybody loved the guy, and they called him the mayor. He was this kind of guy in town. Everyone knows him, everyone loves him. This is a social media post on Facebook the morning of Hurricane Ian. It's a split screen. The top of the screen is a picture out of his house with wet streets. The rain bands have come in. And he said, hopefully it didn't make a bad decision to stay. 8 a.m., 40 miles an hour wind so far. And on the bottom part of the screen, there's a snapshot. Local meteorologist forecast for his area 12 to 16 feet of storm surge. That's 12 to 16 feet of raging salt water coming across his community. That is a terrifying forecast. You can follow his Facebook post through the day of the storm surge arriving, of it coming in the lower part of his house. And then there's a final post around 3 p.m. saying, okay, we're terrified. And that was his last post on Facebook ever. He died in the surge. I mean, this is like just spending 10 days in that zone and seeing so many fatalities. And this haunts me because the meteorologist accurately forecasted the surge. That forecast went into a map. It reached the audience. For Mitch, he not only saw it, he took a screenshot and reposted that forecast, that accurate, terrifying forecast, but somehow didn't connect the 12 to 16 feet of salt water with the fact that he was in so much danger. It was really one of the hardest storms I've ever covered. I mean, it was 6-7 days after landfall, and we still have Chinook helicopters flying overhead doing recoveries. I mean, it was very fatal. We were thinking, 100-plus fatalities in this area. And again, a lot of this probably could have been avoided, but there was just a lot of misconnection and people not connecting the dots that they were in terrible danger. A survivor gave me this picture. I mean, this was just as the surge starts really coming in. It got a lot higher than this. It got up to the rooftops in a lot of cases. And a lot of people, survivors we talked to, said we never imagined that this was going to happen. And so, again, just hard to see. But for me as a science communicator, it's like, okay, where were the communications? Where were the misconnections? And how can this be improved? For me, with future messaging, I want to mention the feet, but I also want to be very descriptive. Like, expect 6 to 8 feet of fast-moving floodwater in your home if your home is not swept away. That kind of thing, that's not hyping it up. In cases like this is exactly what we're seeing on the ground. I wanted to mention, too, just with weather communication, this relates to disasters and extreme events like hurricanes, but it also relates to just communicating well and being descriptive on everyday sunny weather in the summertime. So, quick story, I went home 2 years ago to see my parents. They live on a lake on the Pennsylvania-New York border. My mom's favorite thing in the world is to go swimming in the summertime. Summer afternoon, 1 p.m., I said, Mom, why aren't you putting on your swimsuit? Why aren't you going swimming? And she said, oh, it's gonna be cloudy. I said, no, Mom, it's gonna be partly cloudy, which is exactly the same as mostly sunny. Per the National Weather Service, you can go, if you have a day with 70% blue and 30% clouds, per the National Weather Service, you can call that mostly sunny or you can call that partly cloudy. Because the meteorologist said partly cloudy, my mom wasn't going swimming. And when I said, no, it's gonna be mostly sunny, she said, oh, well, let's go down to the lake, right? Just an innocent little conversation. Times 10,000 on a summer day when people in Houston are hearing the forecast with a 70% blue day. If they hear partly cloudy, they heard the word cloudy. They're not coming to the beach. If they hear mostly sunny, they're getting in the car. So these word choices, the descriptions we use, are very important, not only for disasters, but around here, you better believe 100 times out of 100, I'm calling that mostly sunny when I'm on doing a Facebook Live from the beach. And I'm not doctoring the forecast. I'm being deliberate. And there's nothing more frustrating than a beautiful, hot, sunny day with an empty beach. because people in Houston misunderstood the forecast. Because we put, I'm sorry, I'm on a soapbox. We put hundreds of millions of dollars into the weather forecast. We launched satellites. We have supercomputer networks. We have research teams. And you miss your audience on a word choice. I mean, think about that. My mom wasn't going to go swimming because of the word choice on a forecast that said 70% blue sky. So, again, times that times 10,000 on a summer day. John?
Well, I was teasing you before the meeting started about inaccurate weather forecasting. Since it's like what happened during the freeze, this hard freeze we were supposed to get, it didn't materialize. How can the weathermen become more accountable for accuracy so that things, when they say your home could get swept away, people believe?
Yeah, these are complex things. I mean, I spend a good week or two in disaster zones every summer talking to people, trying to understand how people make decisions. I'm never there with a critical eye. I'm not there to slap people on the wrist or shame them. I'm there to try to understand what were they hearing compared to what happened. For sure, we need to improve forecasts. Sometimes the forecast is flat out wrong. Last couple of days, the National Weather Service forecast has been mid-60s. We've actually been mid-70s. Sometimes it's actually wrong. But a lot of times I'm seeing this kind of thing where the forecast is spot on and somehow there's a misconnection. Somehow this person isn't connecting this with, my life isn't in, like the person, they didn't survive 8 hours past this post because they didn't connect it. So some of it is just perception. In the freeze, I have a dear family that lives below me. He's American, she's from Thailand. She spends all her time gardening. This is 2 weeks ago. I went down and said, Maya, do we need to cover your plants, bring your plants in? She said, no, I think we'll be okay. She's a gardener, she's an amazing gardener. The next morning she goes out, everything's dead. And here she had never seen a freeze in her life. So I was explaining covering, bringing in plants. She had no frame of reference for a freeze. I guarantee you, this person had no frame of reference what a 12 to 16 foot storm surge means. And so the more descriptive we can be, it can really help people out, I think, with that.
Well, I don't know if you would hear Jerry Ike, but there was, our city and our county really failed at communication because of the evacuation of Hurricane Rita. They said, well, the weatherman will be wrong. They didn't call for an evacuation, yet on Monday, Ike fell at midnight Friday. It said on the NOAA Weather Service, if you live in Galveston County, you face imminent peril. So we closed everything down, and they didn't call for an evacuation until Thursday, and 20,000 people stayed on this island. Yeah. And the island flooded because of the way the seawall and everything worked. But if the eye had not come in at Fall of the Rose and had come in at San Luis Pass, we would have had many fatalities. And our city and county has never, nobody's ever talked about it, like what if the same storm comes or whatever. And it was very disappointing. And everybody was like, why are you leaving? Why is our school closing? Yeah. The schools are open. I'm like, I was trained to watch the NOAA Weather Service and that cone of uncertainty if you're in it. And if they put imminent peril.
Yeah, they were very disturbed.
They were very certain that Jeff Masters was, and nobody heard it because they just thought, we're going to sit in traffic. And
well, a lot of people think back to the storm before. That's exactly what happened in Florida. Yeah. They had a bunch of near misses. People were thinking, hey, Rita, I sat in gridlock for a day that was unnecessary in their mind. We're going to wait.
But the Harris County Judge Emmett had done huge campaigns and sent printed materials to all the homes to tell you who should evacuate, who should not. There wasn't anybody on the highway, but I just think it, you know, like really these public figures get their communities into the most trouble and they should have their mouths sealed. And only the NOAA Weather Service people should be telling people what to do because local people are clueless.
It's certainly complex, for sure. For sure. And we really need to, you know, thinking about these communications are really important. Just to wrap up, 6 weeks after Ian, there was one last storm that hit the east coast of Florida. I completely changed how I message for these storms. This was the National Weather Service, this was the National Hurricane Center official forecast on a Tuesday morning for a storm coming in Wednesday night. This was 6 weeks after Ian. And check this out, this is the flood forecast. If you know where to find the P surge, this is probability of surge. This is the same event. I guarantee you, if you're a busy school teacher along the Georgia-South Carolina border, and you're worried about how to get your kids to soccer practice, and you got a million stuff going on in your life, and you have 15 seconds to look at the weather, and you glance at that, I'm thinking, you think, oh, this is going to be a Central Florida storm. So I refuse to show these eye-centric forecasts, starting with Nicole. This was 6 weeks after Ian. And this was the same forecast at the same time from NOAA. They're both NOAA, and this is showing massive storms, or not massive, but 3 to 4 feet over the roadways that'll wash your car away from the same event. So I've started, NOAA has stuff that shows you probability of flood water, probability of threatening winds. And so that's really what's descriptive. I mean, this, real quick and I'll wrap up, but this is this storm Nicole that was coming in. And this is showing this massive wind field. These are tropical storm force winds in orange, pushing a huge surge, northeast Florida, Georgia, South Carolina. The eye is the white dot. When we have these cones of uncertainty, we're saying, where is the white dot gonna go? And I say, who cares? We have this massive wind field. If the eye, you know, wobbles to the north or to the south, it doesn't matter. This is signed, sealed, and delivered. They're getting a substantial coastal flood in coastal Georgia. When I started putting this stuff out, a friend of mine who's an emergency management expert in coastal Georgia, 2 days before the storm, said, thanks for sharing. This is interesting for a few reasons. I hadn't even heard of this storm. She's an emergency management expert in coastal Georgia, 2 days before the storm comes in, and she's telling me, I haven't even heard of this storm. And she mentioned in the last part there, this messaging is noticeably different, where it says, should not focus on potential eye location. This is all messaging I changed post-Ian. So I'm pretty much out of time, but this, she said, I noticed the change immediately, good stuff. And then we were able to efficiently focus on the flooding and not worry about the eye. And she sent me a message 5 hours later. There it is, our local EMA message about Nicole. You beat them by several hours. We were just getting out the important stuff very quickly with this, but changing how we forecast. Again, taking official NOAA stuff, but this was my first Facebook post. Hey, look at these floodwaters coming in. And I was not posting this at all because, again, if I'm in the Georgia-South Carolina border there and I'm a busy person, I have 15 seconds to look at the weather forecast, I'm thinking this is a non-issue, and then all of a sudden my car is being swept off the road by floodwater, and I'm saying the meteorologist missed it again. No, they just communicated. Again, I don't care where the eye goes. This is what I care about. Where are the floodwaters? Where are the wind field? And these are winds over 58 miles an hour that will knock out your power. So again, I know it's a lot of information. We've talked about a lot about weather communication here, but I think it's important in a city like Galveston. We have a lot of disaster history, but a lot of tourism information too. You can check out the podcast, GeoTrek. A lot of great information on all of these topics are talked about every week on our podcast. So thanks, everyone. Yeah, John.
That was a great presentation.
Thank you, sir. I'm just wrapping up, but talk to me afterwards. Or these topics are really interesting, I think, for our disaster prep, but like I mentioned, too, for our tourism. I mean, we need to think how we message weather here has a huge impact on our local economy. So more accurate forecasts are great, but we need to communicate it very accurately as well.
Thank you, Hal. You're a real asset to have on this committee and to the community. Thank you for that presentation, as always. Any last-minute questions, comments for Hal? None? We will move right along to item 11. We have an update on our Wash Ashore exhibit around the island, and Kimberly is going to take that one.
I am. There's no presentation. I'm going to keep this fast. I just want to share some statistics with you all of how the Wash Ashore exhibit has played out so far. Everybody, I'm sure, is familiar with this exhibit. This is the marine debris art that's placed as far west as Artist Boat and as far east as the Royal Caribbean Cruise Terminal. We have 20 pieces across the island. They've been very well received. So I have a few statistics as of this week from the CBB. There's an app associated with it. There have been 301 downloads of the app. And of those 301 downloads, there have been 8,674 check-ins. And the art's been on display for just about a month. So that's great news. It's contributed to 10,000 website visits. And the interesting thing about the website visits is the amount of time that people are spending on the site. They are spending 7 minutes, 13 seconds on our site when they're looking. It's unusual to have somebody stay on a page for more than 2 minutes.
Yeah, as fast as people are.
So, yeah, 7 minutes is the average time that people are staying on the page to learn about the Wash Ashore exhibit. We have over 500 shares on Facebook. that's, it's not unusual for something to be popular on Facebook for us, but what is unusual is for us to have more than 100 shares. So we have 500 shares on Facebook of the exhibits that we're posting. And we've had 26 posts using the hashtag WashAshoreGTX on Instagram, which is not unusual. It's actually kind of low. It kind of points to the idea of using a hashtag as your marker. It's not necessarily the way to go. But as you can see, it's done really well. The CBB is thrilled with what they've seen. Most people that I talk to really love it. We've gotten emails from people off the island that have met us in the past that said, oh, did you know about this? And we say, yeah. Yeah, we did. Or, hey, we know that you put this on. This is so cool. My mom called me and said, hey, there's this really cool exhibit in Galveston right now. She says, who did that? And I was like, Mom, that was the park board. Oh, really? Yeah, I've been talking to you about it for about a month. And the point of that is that she lives in Atlanta. So it's getting out there. The message is going out in the crowd. Interested to hear any feedback that you all have on the exhibits, any experiences that you've had, any frustrations. We know there's been a little bit of frustration with finding some of the pieces. Anything that you think we need to help push the messaging on?
I love that you can touch it, that they encourage you. My husband, because I'm a former art teacher, he's, you know, whenever we go to a museum, I'm like, just don't touch anything. You know, down all the time.
Really good.
You had mentioned to me that Marty wanted me to give an update on the nourishment today as well. So well, do you want me to do that now or just wait?
I thought we were going to bring that back for next month. I mean, give an update if you want.
No, it's happening. It's go down there and look.
It was brought up yesterday at PAC. I guess the sand is changing colors. That's one, I guess, the big news. It's gone from, it's starting to bleach out.
That happens.
Yeah.
It was a big talk yesterday. Excitement.
Sorry to miss that.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, I think we'll bring it back next month once more sand gets
sounds great.
Trucked down the road. All right. I do have one announcement. Allison Buckteen, I apologize for not responding to your email, and I will respond to it. I apologize. I was going to apologize to you in person. You're not here.
That's quite all right.